Welcome to The Warcast, your geopolitical briefing that tells you what you need to know, when you need to know it. The Warcast is for War on the Rocks members only. Spread the word and tell your friends and colleagues to sign up at warontherocks.com/subscribe.
As trade tensions rise between the United States and Canada, we're going to look at the recent history and current ties between the two countries. My guest is Bruce Muirhead, Professor of History and Associate Vice President for External Research at the University of Waterloo. Welcome to the Warcast, Bruce.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Before getting into a more wide-ranging conversation, I think I'd like to start with a specific subject that's probably most Americans know nothing about. What is the story with the dairy industry in Canada, and why is it such a touchy subject when discussing trade relations with the U.S.?
Well, actually, I don't understand why it's such a touchy subject. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny subject, really, between Canada and the U.S. But basically, I guess it boils down to the fact that Canada has a sort of a self-enclosed dairy industry. It's called supply management, where we roughly match domestic demand with domestic supply. So it's closed. It's a highly regulated system, but it's not run by government. It's run by the dairy farmers themselves. So in the province in which I live, Ontario, we have dairy farmers of Ontario. There'd be dairy farmers of Manitoba, dairy farmers of British Columbia, and they all run their provincial organizations. So in the case of dairy, this was implemented in 1966, and it was basically an issue to deal an organization or an attempt to deal with oversupply of dairy, which of course is now plaguing the U.S. market and has for some years as well. But production controls were put in place. So supply management means that it's based upon three pillars. One is producer pricing, and that producers, basically, it's the provincial organizations, they talk to, say, restaurants associations, they have a consumers association connection, they'll deal with individuals, they'll deal with supermarkets, and they eventually come up with pricing that's then prevalent throughout the entire provincial industry. Say, and there are about 23 audit points that they check, so it has to be things, these are all costs, the cost of production, basically, that factors into this. So it would be things like depreciation on equipment, insurance, fuel costs, feed costs, production costs, generally speaking, a wider production cost. So 23 different audit points on that. And that's the price that's negotiated between various organizations in the province and also the dairy farmers of Ontario. So, and that's the price that everybody pays. So included in that, of course, is a salary for the farmer. So we don't have the instability and upheaval in our industry that you do in the United States, because we match domestic supply with domestic production. And as I mentioned, started off with producer pricing, which is how the price is negotiated. The farmer's guaranteed a salary, and we're off to the races on that front. The other part of this is production discipline, which is it's a quota-based system. So quotas have become monetized. And basically, for a kilogram of milk solid in Ontario, the province in which I live, it's about $24,000. So you'd need probably a herd of 50 cows to make a decent living in Canada. The average size of a Canadian dairy farm is 80 cows. So it is a family farm, and most of the newer farms, and there are many, many newer farms, new barns that have been put up, have robots. So it's a highly technological industry. They use the latest technology, the latest information, I think, in terms of developing and running their farms. So Canadian cows are very, very, very productive as well. The last thing is import management, and this is where the issue comes with the Trump administration. We have about 10% of our market open. We have a tariff rate quota of 10%. So that means that, you know, Americans or New Zealanders or Australians can ship up to 10% of the total Canadian market to Canada in fulfillment of our dairy supply requirements. But after 10%, and the tariffs there are 2-3%. After the 10% open share, tariffs increased to 270% or 300%, and basically it's a closed system after that. I should point out, though, that in the U.S., your dairy system is open only to the extent of about 3%. So at the same time that Trump is complaining about our system and basically the 10% tariff rate quota, in the U.S., you have about 3% of your dairy system open for imports, and the rest of it's excluded. So again, there's a bit of hypocrisy, it seems to me, in the American position. But that's why dairy has become such an issue. And of course, more recently as well, probably American listeners aren't all that familiar with the tweets that Trump made from Wisconsin in April of 2017, but they had to do with the fact that 75 Wisconsin dairy farmers had been summarily booted from their processor, Grassland Dairy, simply because they said Canada had changed the milk labeling and as a result had excluded American dairy exports to Canada, ultra-filtered milk, and that had required Grassland Dairy to reduce its processing requirements because they were no longer shipping about $150 million worth of ultra-filtered milk to Canada, which meant that those 75 dairy farmers were simply out of luck and they'd have to find another processor. So Trump got sort of up on his hind legs about this and began to talk about this is something we really have to deal with and our farmers are being treated unfairly. I'd have to say they're not. And in fact, that Grassland Dairy fiasco had a lot more to do with Wisconsin, with Grassland Dairy importing Michigan milk than importing, then being barred at the border from exporting to Canada. You may know Michigan milk at the time was selling for about $5 a hundredweight. The production cost is about $2,100 a hundredweight. So Grassland Dairy looked at that and thought, man, we can make a lot of money with this Michigan stuff if we simply get rid of our Michigan suppliers or our Wisconsin suppliers, which they did, with the result being that it's created an international incident in dairy, which is such a tiny percentage of Canada, U.S.-Canada trade, that it beggars the imagination that it could exercise anybody's attention. You know, basically, U.S. exports about $550 million to Canada. We export about $110 million to the U.S. So the $550 million that the U.S. exports to Canada, it's like a rounding error in the U.S. You know, you have an $18 trillion economy. This isn't even a hiccup, but it's a symbol, I suppose, of how Trump thinks that American dairy farmers are being kicked around by trading partners. Not the case at all. In fact, we've had our system for 52 years now. It's operated quite well. And this is really the first time that anybody's ever said that you can't do this. And basically, that's what Trump is saying. We want to get rid of the Canadian system, which supports Canadian farmers. It's a reflection of Canadian food sovereignty and Canadian food security. And it provides our farmers with a decent income. And we don't have, we're not part of the problem. In fact, we're part of the solution.
All right. So speaking more broadly, what is the state of trade between Canada and the U.S.? Like, what are the major flows across the border and who maintains trade surpluses?
The Canada-U.S. trade relationship is almost perfectly in balance, although we include both tangible goods like products, you know, cars, steel, forest products. Canada has a slight surplus with the U.S., but when everything's taken into consideration, including services, the U.S. is in surplus with Canada. And it's not a huge surplus, and I wouldn't want to hazard a guess on what exactly the number is, but it's certainly, your surplus with us is certainly in the billions of dollars. I'm, again, not entirely sure why your president has decided to pick on us. The economies of the two countries are certainly incredibly integrated. Again, we're about, Canada's about one-tenth the size of the U.S., which is an issue for Canada periodically, of course, throughout our history. As one of our current prime minister's father noted in 1970 or 1972 when President Nixon came to address Parliament, actually, to paraphrase it, no matter how friendly the beast, we're affected by every twitch and grunt. And of course, he was saying the U.S. is an elephant and Canada is a mouse, which is probably the relative sizes of our two economies. Our economy is about $1.8 trillion and yours is 18. So in terms of the overall relationship, it's actually very, very good.
We'll get to the politics of all of this in a minute, but I have one last question on the economic relationship, and that is, you know, what are these tariffs that are being proposed by President Trump? What is Prime Minister Trudeau proposing in response, and what would the economic impacts of those
countries? That the U.S. president's put on against Canadian goods have to do with primarily aluminum and steel, although he's threatened other elements as well, other of the cross-border trading items that we share too. But aluminum and steel are the two. I think it's 10% on aluminum and 25% on steel coming from Canada. Also a bunch of other countries too, and certainly the European Union's included in that. So they're pretty close American allies. And certainly I think in the case of Canada, you can't get an ally that's any closer than Canada is to the United States, you know, in terms of relationship, and has been for a century or more. So it's very, very difficult for Canadians to understand why the president has placed these tariffs on Canadian aluminum and steel. Plus, I think in the U.S., you produce about 550,000
tons of aluminum every year, and your consumption is something like 7 million tons of aluminum. So clearly you're going to have to make it up from somewhere, and Canada is a natural supplier to the U.S. market, and we don't put American workers out of work because of Canadian aluminum exports to the U.S. So again, it's one of those unintelligible things that's happened here. We use American, and again, many, many people now have come to the conclusion that Trump's ultimate objective here, of course, is to put pressure on Canada to cave in on the NAFTA renegotiation. And there are five areas that Trump wants some movement on. One of them is the dairy supply management issue that I talked about before. There is a sunset clause that Trump wants in the NAFTA renegotiation as well, that after 5 years, you have to, the countries involved have to renew it. Of course, Canada doesn't want this, nor does Mexico, because no business is going to invest, say, in Canada when confronted by the possibility that maybe in 5 years, you know, you're going to have to go through this whole process all over again and maybe renegotiate the agreement and maybe not get an agreement. So we've vetoed that in a sense to the extent that it's possible for Canada to veto anything. There's another issue about auto manufacturing, that there are certain American requirements about content in cars sold in North America. And again, the Canadian industry is completely and utterly integrated with the American industry. Sometimes parts, car parts, cross the borders, you know, 20 times before the final car is produced. So that's an issue. We don't like what the U.S. has produced, has offered on that front. And this is a very, very important industry to us. Again, it's hugely symbolic and hugely important in Canada, the manufacture of cars, and it's largely done in Ontario too. But in the U.S., it's a relatively, I think it's not minor, but it's not huge, the part that's integrated with Canada. It's mainly the big three and Toyota as well that's located in Ontario. They're fabricated cases as they begin to. There are a number of issues that continue to crop up between Canada and the United States, and as I've said, I'm not entirely sure why any of this has become an issue, and it's not possible for Canada to give in on all of the five areas that that Trump has demanded.
I think that these tensions surprise a lot of people on both sides of the border. For me, I've never seen U.S.-Canadian relations to be like this. Could you tell us, you know, is this truly unprecedented in the history of relations between our two countries? You know, not going back to the War of 1812, of course, you know.
Yeah. And more I have to say, though, you know, that it wasn't us that burned the White House, but it was the British. I know Trump has brought that up recently with Justin Trudeau. And also that the burning of the White House was done in retaliation for American forces landing at what was then called York. It's now Toronto, and burning the colonial parliament buildings at the time. So the British only went to Washington after American forces had burned our stuff down here. So, but that's a whole other thing. We did have an issue. It was in the prime ministership of John Diefenbaker. He was prime minister in Canada from 1957 to 1963. And actually, he got along very well with the Eisenhower administration. So Eisenhower, of course, retires from politics in 1960. And John Kennedy assumes the presidency in January of 1961. And Kennedy and Diefenbaker hated each other passionately. It's the same. I don't think that Trump and Trudeau, the current Trudeau, hate each other passionately. You know, it's maybe a misunderstanding, a degree or something like that. But the personal relationship between Diefenbaker and Kennedy was absolutely non-existent. And in fact, Kennedy was on a state trip to Canada once, and he was actually planting a tree at the governor general's house. And he, as you know, he had a bad back, and he put his back out further. And I think it really, he was in pain when he was visiting Canada, couldn't show it, of course. So it was just a horrible situation. He blamed that on Diefenbaker, that Diefenbaker had made him plant the tree as well. Anyway, the presidential prime ministerial relationship was non-existent at that point. But beneath that level, and again, I'm not entirely sure what's happened beneath the Trudeau-Trump relationship now, but beneath the Diefenbaker-Kennedy relationship, that level, there was a good relationship among Canadian officials and American officials. You know, back in the 60s and the late 50s and 60s, they'd all gone to the same schools. They all spoke the same language. They all had the same sort of political and social and cultural context in which they operated. So there was a meeting of minds at the officials level, which perhaps doesn't exist today between Trump and Trudeau. But the situation today isn't without precedent. It's just that this one seems to be a bit more intractable, I think, than the relationships before. Also, Richard Nixon didn't like Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau. Richard Nixon, it's on one of the tapes, he referred to Pierre Trudeau, who was prime minister between 1968 and 1984. He referred to him as an asshole, and Pierre Trudeau's response to that was, "I've been called worse things by better people." So, I mean, that relationship was also a taxing one and quite fraught. But again, beneath that, the president-prime-minister relationship, things weren't actually horrible. And the continental relationship operated within a certain context and a certain rationality, which it still does, at least we think it still does today. And it continued on with barely a blip, I think, even given the hostility it demonstrated, usually by an American president towards a Canadian prime minister, not so much the other way around. We can't afford it. So it's a bit of a difficult situation for us. But this one, Trump does seem to be a bit of an outlier, as some people in the United States have suggested as well, not just Canadians. And this is a very difficult situation for any Canadian prime minister to be in, because there doesn't seem to be any reasoning with the administration's position on trade and what it wants.